Well, hello again, everyone. So I'm very pleased to welcome for our next talk Max Jones from Bristol University, who will be talking about the origins of counterfactual thought.
Hello, lovely to see you all. I'm very sad that I can't be there, and partly because it's strange to see you all in Cambridge. I think you're about 200 metres away from where I grew up, and also just because I've had to miss all of your talks and I get to hear my own talk, which I'm less excited by. But I'm going to try and get through this pretty quickly as possible so I can get as much discussion in, really. So I think, let's get going and we'll see. So I'm going to be talking about the origins of counterfactual thought and try and say something a bit about why they matter. So here's a rough overview of what I'm going to do. So I guess I first encountered this stuff in connection with Timothy Williamson's argument for grounding modal knowledge in our capacity for counterfactual thought. But I think there's some interesting things that kind of are lurking under the surface there about this assumptions about where we think counterfactual thought comes from and what it's like. So I think I'm going to try and focus in on them with the aim of sort of that they might be more relevant outside of just the argument that Williamson offers. In particular, I think that a lot of the time when thinking about the origins of counterfactual thought, we assume that it's that the capacity is kind of domain general. And so I'm going to be looking at questioning that reasons why you might doubt the domain generality of counterfactual thought. Now, I think the assumption of domain generality is really important for Williamson's argument for modal knowledge, but I think, again, it has wider implications. In particular, I'm going to be looking at a kind of development of Williamson's account by Kroebel, which explicitly appeals to evolutionary explanations. Then I'm going to look to various kind of alternative hypotheses about origins of counterfactual law, all kind of up in the air, not going to argue for these being the correct one, but just argue that these kind of might be the question, domain specificity in various ways. Okay. So, firstly, I need to thank John and Cheyenne for their great work on the Thinking Counterfactually project that I was working on last year. So, a lot of this is based on our conversations and work there, but also partly based on work with Tom Schoenen from the University of Amsterdam, who nicely I met at the last UNOC conference, and we've been working on that stuff since. So, that's a nice callback. Okay, so as I say, I'm going to kind of take as a stimulus Williamson's argument that we can explain our ability to acquire knowledge of metaphysical modality on the basis of our natural or ordinary capacity for counterfactual thought. So this kind of takes two steps. First, explaining why we have a reliable capacity for counterfactual thought, and then showing that that capacity is sufficient for acquiring knowledge of metaphysical modality. So that's the kind of this is the kind of step that most people have focused on. So a lot of people have challenged the idea that our natural capacity for counterfactual thought is sufficient to give rise to kind of the kind of knowledge of metaphysical modality that Williamson's after. And you might think, you know, how did I find all these many different articles doing that? And it took a while for me, but luckily, I'm just going to do a quick plug. You can easily find things to do with counterfactuals on a specific topic by using the wonderful repository that we create. Anyway, enough advertising. So elsewhere in my own work, I try to do the same kind of move of arguing that it's a problem with Williamson's move from natural or ordinary counterfactual thought to modal knowledge. In particular, so Ruth Byrne's work, based on that, I argued that our ordinary counterfactual thought involves kind of different sorts of mechanisms that are going to be required for modal knowledge in Williamson's account. Leaving that kind of argument to the side, though, for today, I think the problem with this is it's hard to make that kind of argument, or even all some of the other arguments that people put forward about the move from counterfactual thought to modal knowledge, hard to pin them down because Williamson gives quite a sparse account of counterfactual thought and what its origins are. So it's hard to exactly work out what the kind of mechanism he's committed to is that's going to be responsible for counterfactual thought, arguably in his case, so for him, both in the case of modal knowledge and in counterfactual thought. So I think it's really important to actually look at this first step, and I don't think, so fewer people have actually looked at that. I put a little star next to Casulo's paper, because he does touch on the issue of what are basic mechanisms of counterfactual authorities, but adopts a different line of attack. Okay, so that's the bit I'm going to go for. So, unlike Williamson, Thomas Curdle explicitly aims to provide an evolutionary explanation of the reliability of counterfactual thought, and he hopes to do so in order to provide what is an evolutionary explanation of our modal knowledge. So he explicitly says that the origins of our reliable counterfactual thought are in evolution by natural selection, and that this explains the reliability of our counterfactual thought, and this in turn explains the reliability of modal knowledge. So this is going to be the main focus, but I'm not primarily aiming to provide a counter-argument to Williamson or Curdle. I think there are interesting ways in which what I'm going to say does cause problems for them. But I think I want to challenge this wider assumption that evolution is going to give rise to a domain general capacity as a counter-argument. I think this is important because there are many things about Curdle's explanation that could be seen as problematic, and lots of arguments that you could bring up against his view. But I actually think that the way he expresses it and the kind of story he expresses is often going on in the background when we think about counterfactual thought without being critical and without paying attention to the cognitive sciences explanations of that. So that's going to be kind of the wider goal. So a rough argument, and it is very rough, it might not even be an argument, this is still very much work in progress, based on various different strands of thought. Williamson and Curdle, and many others, I think maybe even me at times, you assume that we have a single domain general mechanism for counterfactual thought that evolved as the result of natural selection. I'm going to propose some viable alternative hypotheses, I think at least possible alternative hypotheses, that suggests that counterfactual thought might be supported by domain-specific mechanisms, it might be supported by multiple independent mechanisms. Now, I would argue that these first two ideas undermine the kind of move that Williamson and Curdle want to make, because we can't guarantee this kind of general reliability of counterfactual thought, particularly the kind that we needed in the more exotic philosophical thought experiments kind of context that they're trying to explain. If we have domain-specific mechanism, that's the origins of counterfactual thought, then that's going to be problematic. However, I'm going to put forward a third alternative hypothesis, which is just to point to the fact that it's, I think, very likely that most of our cognitive practices associated with counterfactual thought are shaped by our cognitive technologies, by our language, by our formalizations of counterfactuals. And actually, that kind of undermines some of the worries that might arise from counterfactual thought being domain-specific. So I'm going to come to kind of argue that we should be cautious in assuming the general reliability of counterfactual thought, because there can be hidden contingent constraints that come from the particular origins of our capacity for counterfactual thought. And so we need to pay more attention to the developing empirical evidence about where counterfactual thought comes from. But I also think that we don't need an evolutionary argument to support the reliability of counterfactual thought, and it's precisely the way in which our technologies alter counterfactual thought that may mean that it can serve exactly the purpose that we want it to in philosophy. And this is good because it allows us to have room for progress. You know, we can actually get better at thinking about counterfactuals, and we don't have to understand philosophy as kind of using counterfactual thought or thinking about modality using Stone Age minds. We have different minds because we've developed different technologies to engage in this stuff. Okay, so a brief kind of look at Williamson Curdle's work before we got to this. So, I mean, mainly focusing on the first half, but for those who haven't, I think most of you probably be quite familiar with Williamson's argument from counterfactual thought to modal knowledge. I have a quick, very quick explanation of what he says. So, I think the key part of the argument is that Williamson exploits the logical equivalence between modal attributions and certain kinds of counterfactual conditional to explain how counterfactual thought supports our knowledge of metaphysical modality. So, he argues that we kind of have this natural, reliable ability to evaluate counterfactuals. And then since modal attributions are equivalent to these particular counterfactuals, the capacity for counterfactual thought allows us to gain modal knowledge. So Williamson tends to focus on the first two pairs of these. So for necessarily A, it'd be if not A were the case, then it'd be a contradiction, and for possibly A, it's equivalent to if it's not the case, that if A were the case, then there wouldn't be a contradiction. You can kind of see the others here. Crudel, alternatively, tends to focus on the third ones. I think this is partly, from what I remember, that Williamson doesn't want to commit himself to accounts that quantify over propositions. The important thing to focus on here is that the kind of counterfactuals that we're dealing with are quite strange. They're not intuitive. How we think about contradictions and how we think about internally contradictory kind of counterfactuals is an interesting thing that I have looked at elsewhere. The other important thing is that clearly we're going to need some kind of domain general notion here. We have to be able to think about a conditional in its pure form of connecting some contents, independent of what those contents are. And this is the part that I think is going to be challenged. Okay. There's a lot more that can be said about that, and lots of people have said a lot about it, so I'm not going to go much into the move from reliable counterfactual to our own knowledge. I'm going to focus on this first step. So, Williamson says the following. Humans evolved under no pressure to do philosophy. Presumably, survival and reproduction in the Stone Age depended little on the philosophical prowess, dialectical skill being no more effective than now as a seduction technique, and in any case dependent on a hearer already equipped to recognise it. Any cognitive capacity of a philosophy is a more or less accidental byproduct of other developments. So this is an important part of the story, is that modal knowledge, and particularly our ability in philosophy to acquire modal knowledge, is not something that was evolved for, it's a byproduct of some other capacity. And so, instead of kind of trying to look for an evolutionary explanation, philosophical methodology of our access to knowledge and metaphysical modality from the outset, we should look for some other cognitive capacity that can support our knowledge of metaphysical modality, and this is where counterfactual thought comes in. So, Williamson says, we should expect the cognitive capacities used in philosophy to be cases of general cognitive capacities used in ordinary life, perhaps trained, developed, and systematically applied in various special ways. So, I'm going to come back to that. Just as the cognitive capacities that we use in mathematics and natural science are rooted in more primitive cognitive capacities to perceive, imagine, correlate, reason, discuss, etc. In particular, a plausible non-skeptical epistemology of modality should assume our capacity to discriminate metaphysical possibilities from metaphysical impossibilities under more general cognitive capacities used in ordinary life. The ordinary cognitive capacity to handle counterfactual conditionals carries with it the cognitive capacity to handle metaphysical modality. But the question is, where does that ordinary capacity to handle counterfactual conditionals come from? So Crudel agrees with Williamson that we can't give a direct evolutionary explanation of modal knowledge. So he also suggests that having true modal beliefs is not a terribly useful thing, at least it does not seem much help out in the wilderness. But it doesn't follow that no evolutionary explanation of the reliability of the processes that form our modal beliefs can be given. Again, Crudel emphasises a trait might be explained as a byproduct of some useful trait. So both agree that the capacity for modal knowledge is itself a byproduct of our natural capacity for ordinary counterfactual thought. And Crudel explicitly proposes an evolutionary explanation of our knowledge of metaphysical modality. So he says that the project he's engaged in is to explain modal knowledge from the reliability of the processes that produce our modal beliefs. And that reliability is in turn explained by an evolutionary account of why our modal beliefs should be formed by reliable processes and an explanation of the nature of these processes. That is, an account of the cognitive mechanisms that implement them. And here's the key part. He argues that the epistemology of counterfactual conditionals lends itself to an evolutionary explanation. And he kind of gives what, I mean, you might argue is a somewhat just-so story. I'm just going to kind of let you judge it for yourself, because I'm not going to be interested in this specific story. I think there's a lot more to what Crudel says than perhaps this example that's coming gives us. Okay, So on the face of it, having a reliable capacity for evaluating counterfactual conditions is useful because it enables us to learn from mistakes. Something goes badly, we reason that if such and such had happened, the outcome would have been better. We resolve to bring such and such about if we are in a similar situation in the future. When we are finally in a similar situation, we do bring such and such about. So here's the final example. Our success in avoiding the bad outcome in the future may have significant practical utility and may even be life-saving. For instance, suppose that I'm attacked by a tiger while asleep during an expedition and only narrowly escaped death. I reason that I would not have been attacked by a tiger if I had lit a campfire and resolved to light a campfire on similar occasions in the future. Doing so, I avoid tiger attacks for the remainder of the expedition and return home safely. Okay, so that's one way of explaining what goes on when we learn from our mistakes. It's clear that there are, particularly this specific case, there are other ways you can explain the reasoning that's required for learning from mistakes. So it seems like, you know, the person in question already has knowledge that campfires scare off tigers. And they also already have a desire not to be attacked by a tiger. So it seems like, you know, there are different ways one could come to the conclusion of lighting campfires is good for getting rid of tigers, and that one should do so in future. Another option is that perhaps instead of engaging in counterfactual thought, and this is one that Crowell acknowledges, perhaps we engage in probabilistic reasoning. And so there are definitely other explanations out there of this specific type of learning. Crowell argues that evolution is more likely to give rise to counterfactual thought than probabilistic reasoning, because counterfactual thought is simpler. Now, I'm not entirely sure what is meant by the simplicity here. It's kind of hinted at by the following point, which is that we introspectively find explicit probabilistic reasoning more difficult, and so Crowell takes this to be evidence that counterfactual thought is simpler. Now, again, I think there's problems with this step, too. But I'm going to leave that kind of these issues with Crowell's particular story by the side, because I think it's more important just to focus on this idea that maybe we do have evolved counterfactual thought. And also, I think there's important issues regarding the extent to which counterfactual thought is dispensable that I'm not going to talk about here, because Cheyenne, who I worked with last year, has done a lot of work on this and presented it at the last UConn conference. So leave that to her for now. Okay, I think the really key thing here, though, is that Crowell goes from the idea that making correct evaluations of counterfactual conditionals means that we're likely to evolve a system for counterfactual thought. The ability to evaluate counterfactual correctly will be selected for. But the ability to evaluate counterfactuals correctly is not the same as being able to evaluate counterfactual conditionals. In that we don't need to have formalized anything into a counterfactual conditional to kind of make the kind of inference that we might describe in counterfactual terms that Crowell talked about earlier. So it's this idea that, like this canon, we've evolved the ability to deal with the counterfactual sin, with the box and the triangle, box and the arrow. That I'm going to really be challenging. Okay. So moving on. So both Williamson and Crowell posit a natural ability to comprehend and evaluate counterfactual conditionals. Crowell argues that this mechanism was shaped by natural selection, but the question to look at is which counterfactual conditionals. On the one hand, we might have a general ability to evaluate anything that we would want to formalise in terms of this conditional, you see here. It assumes that at least the argument from counterfactual thought to mobile knowledge relies on the assumption that the reliability of counterfactual thought is independent of the content of the antecedent and the consequent of a particular counterfactual condition. Particularly given, you know, the kind of counterfactual conditionals that Williamson was interested in, where we have, you know, a contradiction as one of the as the consequence. Any restriction of the scope of the content for which our counterfactual thought is reliable is potentially going to infect the scope of reliability of our access to modal knowledge, particularly in these cases that Williams is interested in when we're concerned with philosophical thought experiments and the like. And so this is one of these issues where it's difficult to work out. So the notion of domain specificity within the cognitive sciences is kind of fraught in terms of how best to define it. Because there's a certain sense in which the mechanism that Crodel posits is domain-specific, in the sense that it deals with a specific kind of inference, pertaining to a specific kind of conditional, the counterfactual conditional. However, it's domain-general in the sense that it can deal with content from any domain. Is it legitimate to define a specific cognitive domain in terms of a conditional, rather than in terms of a kind of content? Exploring and perhaps maybe thoughts about, and would any such mechanism, any such domain general mechanism in terms of content, be likely to evolve? So I think that the scenarios, at least the kind of scenarios that Crodel posits, where counterfactual thought is useful for learning from mistakes, are likely to be restricted to a specific kind of domain. In particular, it's only useful to take into account ways in which things could have gone differently that we could have done something about, stuff that's part within our control. Learning from mistakes is useful only in so far as it allows one to correct one's actions. So, the kind of scenarios in which it's going to be useful to use counterfactual thoughts are going to be restricted in some sense. Now, you might think the restrictions themselves are different from the ones I've given. There may be other cases where it's useful. However, there's going to be some kind of domain-relevant restriction, so that there might be some restriction of domain, kind of whatever story you tell about this emergence. But I think the important thing is there's quite a lot of evidence from some of Ruth Byrne's work, that we do have kind of biases in terms of the kind of counterfactuals that we focus on. So people tend to focus, when engaging in counterfactual thought, on controllable events and actions, and to see these kind of things as more mutable than others. So the question is a domain general or a domain specific mechanism more likely to evolve to fulfill the goal of dealing with specific kinds of domain? Now, in discussions of domain specificity and domain generality in the literature from evolutionary psychology, the kind of things being used as evidence for a domain-specific mechanism, particularly when it comes to logical inferences, is the weights and selection task. So, some of you may have seen this before, but it's not, I'm going to quickly go through it. Obviously, you're all quite adept at logic, so you may be better at this problem than the usual people. So the question is, how can you test the following rule by turning over as few cards as possible? And the question subjects have to answer is, if a card has a circle on one side, then it's yellow on the other side. Give you a second to think about that. Which cards should you turn over? That's not a rhetorical question. Someone have a go, just for...
1 and 4.
Yeah.
Good. Well, obviously you knew that because most people get that. I think up to, so in some of the early experiments, as low as 10% of people often get that wrong and say that they have to turn over the circle in the yellow square often. So I'm not going to commit to any of this particular interpretation of this result, but one of the important results that Cosmides and Tooby, evolutionary psychologists and proponents of massive modularity, they found that subjects perform much better on a logically equivalent task when the domain is changed. So when subjects are given the following problem, how can you test to get people drinking in a bar, one person drinking beer, one person drinking Coca-Cola, one person who's 16 and one person who's 22, and you have to see if a person drinks an alcoholic drink, then they must be over 18, you have to see whether that's true. People find it really easy to know who's checking this circumstance. Okay. So that is clearly 1 and 3. The important thing here is we have variance in performance on logically equivalent tasks. And the explanation from the point of view of Cosmides and Toomey and other proponents of evolutionary psychology is that we have a domain-specific cheater detection module. So, you know, we have two systems that are both capable of performing formally the same kind of inference, but one of them is better than the others because it's evolved, but it only deals with a specific type of content, content to do with detecting social violations. So, I don't think you necessarily need to adopt a massive modularity view to still see that this evidence speaks against the kind of domain general capacity for logical reasoning. In the case of the indicative conditional, we kind of expect multiple domain-specific mechanisms, which all allow us to carry out relevant kind of reasoning, but perhaps in with different levels of reliability for each different mechanism. So you should expect similar restrictions on the domain generality of counterfactual thought. We shouldn't be able to, shouldn't expect ourselves to be equally good at reasoning about any counterfactual conditional, regardless of what the antecedent and consequent are. We should think that there are restrictions relevant to the domain that those the subjects of the antecedent and consequent apply to. Now, the difficult thing is it's not obvious how you would construct the equivalent of a Weyson selection task for counterfactual conditionals. I'm interested to know, think about how you might kind of go about investigating similar things. That's another important thing to take into account is that one of the main arguments, again, in the cognitive sciences against the idea of domain general reasoning mechanisms is that the operations that such systems need to carry out are computationally intractable. By positing multiple domain-specific mechanisms, that's meant to overcome the problem because each mechanism only has to deal with a limited domain of information to search from and avoiding various problems of computation intractability. Now, you might think that if this is true for even kind of mundane forms of reasoning, then it's likely to also be true for counterfactual thinking, at least if you model it in similar terms. Because that presumably requires even more computational resources. Now, I don't have a good argument for that, but I think, for example, one reason you might think so is the problem of co-tenability, that we have to keep in mind the right background conditions for a counterfactual conditional. Now, the ability to select the right background conditionals seems like exactly the kind of problem that gives rise to intractability worries in the case of domain general reasoning mechanisms. So rather than assuming a domain general capacity for counterfactual thought, we should expect evolution to give rise to maybe multiple domain-specific counterfactual thought, with the specific domain determined by the kind of situations in which counterfactual thought was useful to our ancestors, at least on this kind of line of reasoning. But importantly, there might be domain-specific constraints then on the reliability of counterfactual thought, so we won't be able to assume that the reliability of counterfactual thought is the same across the board. Importantly, though, these constraints might not be accessible to introspection. They might not be the kind of constraints that one would expect. And one of the reasons for that, which will become clear in the next section, is that they're not the kind of things... It's because the kind of domain-specific systems that give rise to counterfactual thought, we might be able to tell a similar story to how Williamson and Crowell approach modal knowledge, in the counterfactual thought itself might be a byproduct of some other more basic mechanism. So the constraints that transmit to counterfactual thought itself might not be the ones we expect when we just consider counterfactual thought in kind of isolation, because they might be consequences of counterfactual thought itself relying on some other system. Okay. So importantly, these constraints might only be discoverable through empirical study, and in order to understand these constraints, we're going to have more dialogue between cognitive sciences and philosophical approaches. Okay, so now I'm going to put forward what I think is some vaguely plausible, sort of quite supported by some empirical work, possible alternative origins of counterfactual thought. Remember that Crowell and perhaps implicitly Williamson argue that we have a capacity that evolved precisely for counterfactual thought. And they use this to explain how we can get modal knowledge as a byproduct of that capacity. But But they fail to consider that counterfactual thought may, as we understand, may itself be a byproduct of another cognitive capacity. So, in essence, counterfactual thought may inherit the constraints of one of these other domains, and then following their argument, modal knowledge, access to modal knowledge might also be hampered by the similar constraints. And importantly, these might be hidden from introspection. Okay, so one important area where counterfactual thought seems closely related is the issue of social cognition and, in particular, theory of mind. So there's evidence suggesting a link between counterfactual thought and theory of mind. Both follow relatively similar developmental trajectories, at least depending on the kind of evidence you look at. Counterfactual capacities are correlated performance on false belief tasks. And I think the false belief task has, you know, it's a paradigm experiment for testing theory of mind, and it's quite easy to see why you might see a link between counterfactual thought and false belief tasks. So in the classic Sally Ann task that you've probably all seen before, an infant's shown a kind of set of scenes like the following. So you've got a Sally with a basket and Ann with a box. Sally puts a ball in the basket. Then when Sally leaves the room, Ann moves the ball from the basket to the box. And then the children are asked, when Sally comes back, where will she look for her ball? Now obviously once children have good theory in mind, they'll assume that she has the false belief that the ball is in the basket. Whereas before they develop theory in mind, they'll assume that Sally will see that the ball, know that the ball is where they've seen the ball be put. So they'll think the ball is in the box. So one explanation of all of this that is kind of quite natural, and the naturalness is what's dangerous about this, is that the data behind theory of mind, that our theory of mind depends on our capacity for counterfactual thought. So you might kind of hypothesise that in order for the infant to be able to understand Sally's false belief, the infant needs to be able to think, if I were Sally, I would think the ball is in the basket. Okay? So that's one explanation of what's going on here. And this would fit with Crowell's account of a kind of domain general kind of capacity for counterfactual thought that supports a wide variety of other capacities, like access to mental knowledge. The problem is there's alternative hypothesis is that the capacity for counterfactual thought itself is dependent on a capacity for theory of mind. Now, this makes quite a lot of sense because as social creatures, theory of mind is really essential to our survival. And so it may be that once we have this capacity for theory of mind, it then plays lots of other roles. So theory of mind and various other aspects of social cognition require the ability to represent mental states of others that differ from one's own. Among these, one can represent someone's strongly held belief that the world is other than one knows it to be, or other than one believes it to be, and then reason about what one would expect in that given scenario. Now, here you can see this is pretty much already all we need to have a capacity for counterfactual thought. Once you're able to think about what someone would expect given their strongly held beliefs, you're able to reason about what would be the case were something to be the case. So perhaps these kind of representations of other people's beliefs can play the role of the antecedent states in counterfactual thought. But once you've got the ability to do that, perhaps we can just represent false mental states that don't belong to any particular agent. We can just represent what could follow from something being the case, or what one would expect given a belief that that's the case. So this would put some constraints on the nature of counterfactual thought. Not necessarily to say that counterfactual thought can only be used in a social context, but there may just be features of the mechanism that underlies theory of mind that infect our counterfactual thought. So I'm not saying that counterfactual thought is an essentially social capacity, it's just that it might be supported by a mechanism for social that initially evolved to serve a completely different domain-specific function. Now, one of the real difficulties with all of this stuff, and one of the things that make Ruth Byrne's work really impressive, is that counterfactual thought is a really difficult thing to test for. It has very few behavioural correlates, right? A lot of the time you'll just think about what would have been the case and there won't be any obvious action going with it. So, with that in mind, I mean, there is some evidence that suggests that theory of mind emerges earlier than counterfactual thought, which would kind of suggest that perhaps it is the basis for a counterfactual thought. But we have to be really careful here, because the evidence for the earlier emergence of theory of mind often comes from different forms of false belief tasks that are done non-verbally, so measuring infant's surprise or through their looking time. Now, it's not clear how you can do a similar non-verbal test for counterfactual thoughts. You can't necessarily see whether an infant is thinking about what could have been otherwise. So, I think the important thing is the relationship between theory of mind and counterfactual thought is still up for debate, either could be right. Now, what does this mean? It certainly doesn't mean that we should sort of question the reliability of counterfactual thought. Precisely, it's sort of in general, the reason that the theory of mind hypothesis about the origins of counterfactual thought works is precisely because that kind of mechanism could, in many cases, do exactly the job we need. So I'm not saying that counterfactual thought, as a result of these origins, is going to be restricted to only being reliable if it's dealing with the kind of content that is related to the specific domain we're focusing on. I'm just saying that there may be some constraints from the demands of that mechanism that infect counterfactual thought. So we shouldn't expect just some content-neutral or domain-general reliability. The constraints on social cognition may have unexpected impacts on counterfactual thought. And it's this unexpected bit that's important. We can't just infer what those impacts would be given the original content. So that's one alternative hypothesis. Here's another one which I think is probably more well-founded. So both Williamson and Ruth Byrne's work both emphasise the role of imagination in counterfactual thought. Whether that means that counterfactual thought is itself domain general or specific kind of depends on what you think about domain generality or domain specificity of imagination. Now, recent years there's been a lot of growing evidence that a lot of capacities, related capacities, are supported by the same kind of system. And these include episodic memory, planning, counterfactual thought, and various other forms of imagination. And these are supported by a capacity for offline simulation of perceptual motor processes. This is known as embodied imagination. Importantly here, counterfactual thought would be just one capacity of a system that evolved to fill a wide range of functions. In particular, this would be a system that can both work online and offline. So if we think that imagination is embodied, and imagination results from reactivation of perceptual and motor systems, then, and this is important, whether or not it involves conscious mental imagery, that's kind of by the by. If we think that imagination in general involves this reactivation of perceptual and motor systems, then our capacity for imagination-based counterfactual thought is likely to be constrained by the kinds of body by the kinds of perceptual and motor systems we have and the kind of constraints on those systems. Now, this is not actually controversial at all. We all kind of accept this to some extent. So, importantly, no one thinks that somehow considering the counterfactual conditional, if I were a bat, then I would feel like X, gets us any further in responding to Nagel's worry about what it's like to be a bat. We all agree that some counterfactual conditionals are unreliable, our evaluation of some counterfactual conditionals is going to be unreliable due to the nature of the bodies we have. We can't be reliable across the board. But I think, you know, that's one case where we can introspectively assess our lack of reliability. But they're not always going to be like that. So here's a nice case of a kind of constraint on imagination that people don't often anticipate. So if you open your mouth as wide as possible, keep it open, and imagine saying the word bubbles, it's much harder to do than if you have your mouth closed. And don't say bubbles. Right, this is just one of many kind of cases like this. You get other similar cases like, I mean, it's hard for me to think about because I'm currently on a spinny chair, but if you imagine standing still and try and imagine turning your head right the way round, like in The Exorcist, I guess, so that you see the scene again, but while keeping your body still. This is reported as phenomenologically a case where you kind of can't imagine it, but people think in advance they will be able to. Now, these are kind of perhaps an interesting case, particularly in the case of what we're interested in terms of counterfactual thought. The important thing here is just that there may be constraints on our imagination due to the nature of our perceptual and motor systems that we can't anticipate from the outside in advance, and we can't introspect them. If we think that counterfactual thought is to some extent embodied, then we need to ascertain what the embodied constraints on counterfactual thought be to know which situations it's going to be reliable in. And it's not just going to be unreliable in those obvious cases like trying to imagine that you're a bat. And this is linked to the problem that Blackburn highlights, that we just can't introspectively distinguish the limitations of our imagination that are due to our... Sorry, we can't distinguish limitations of the imagination that are due to our own cognitive constraints from limitations of our imagination due to the impossibility of the thing that we're trying to imagine. Now, that's one example, but there may be loads of other cases where we just lack introspective access to the limitations of our imagination. Good, so again, we get hidden constraints on counterfactual thought. If it's a byproduct of kind of, well, maybe not domain-specific embodied mechanisms, but constrained by the kind of body-specific kind of embodied mechanisms, then it might be... Then all of our counterfactual thought might be limited by those limitations. So, again, I'm not saying that we can only use counterfactual thought to deal with perceptual motor content here. It's just that there may be limitations that we can't predict in advance. Right. So Kreutzer's evolutionary account of the origins of counterfactual thought failed to rule out alternatives that potentially undermine the general reliability of counterfactual thought. It seems likely that counterfactual thought may be supported by domain-specific mechanisms. And it may be supported by many systems, right? With reliability depending on the map between the system used and the target domain. We might use different systems for counterfactual thought on different occasions. Now, at first you might think, sort of pushing this skeptical line, there's all these hidden constraints on our counterfactual thought that we need to worry about. But that's not the line I want to push. I think sort of the strange thing is we come full circle, and hopefully at the end we need to carry on doing things precisely as we were before, with a slight bit more caution. So, so far we've been assuming that Kreutzer was right to look for an evolutionary explanation for counterfactual thought in order to provide an evolutionary explanation of modal knowledge. But it's not clear that we should think that either depend on evolved abilities, or that somehow providing an evolutionary explanation actually explains the reliability anyway. This is never how we tend to explain reliability in philosophy up till now, and just simply the evolved usefulness of some... the usefulness, potential usefulness of some faculty is not a good enough reason that we'll have evolved a reliable mechanism for carrying out that thing. And just because something is useful, it doesn't mean we'll end up with the right kind of mechanism. So it's important to focus on the second part of Williamson's own explanation, that we should expect the concept of capacity used in philosophy to cases of general cognitive capacities that have been trained, developed, and systematically applied in special ways. Now, I think the thing here that Williamson talks about these abilities is if they're kind of the same ability that have been enhanced in some way, they've been honed. But I think this misses out on the fact that the really important part of of much of our cognition is that we employ cognitive technologies. We invent new ways of thinking, and these impact on the nature of our thought. So more emphasis should be placed on the way that we develop our cognitive capacities through interaction with the environment that we're brought up in. And in doing so, we might be able to avoid these kind of worries. So I think, and this is important, because I think that we all do this to some extent. So it's really natural to think of our capacity for counterfactual thought as kind of a precursor to the capacity to talk about counterfactual. We first need to be able to do counterfactual thought before we can linguistically express subjunctive conditions. And then from that, from our language, when we talk about counterfactuals, we then get formalizations of counterfactuals, and we get the counterfactual condition, which we tend to think sort of naturally captures the initial Stone Age counterfactual thought that emerged. But this neglects what's quite a kind of well-known, sort of well-established view, that our formalizations can themselves impact on the way we think about counterfactuals, and our counterfactual language can itself impact on counterfactual thought. Most of the kind of knowledge we gain in science, in mathematics, in philosophy, does not require an evolutionary explanation qua epistemology. That doesn't mean the origins aren't interesting, and it doesn't mean we don't have to be careful of pitfalls where we might go wrong because of the underlying mechanisms that we're utilising. However, that we shouldn't think that that somehow counterfactual thought has remained unchanged for all these years. It's impacted by the practices that we have. And really importantly, the invention of, I mean, one of the important things about inventing the cognitive practice, the cognitive technology of formal logic and formal systems is precisely that it allows us to think about things in ways that are alien to our natural abilities. It's precisely by inventing a counterfactual conditional, a symbol that where you can have, which we can think about in isolation from whatever the content, the antecedent, and the consequent is, that we gain the capacity for domain general counterfactual thought. So, in a certain sense, precisely the reason we develop these practices in philosophy is to allow us to overcome the limitations of our evolved domain-specific capacities. And the idea that philosophy has its own distinct and exceptional methodology needn't be a problem or a reason for scepticism in and of itself. What does this all mean then? So I think, firstly, evolutionary explanations for the general reliability of counterfactual thought are unwarranted because they neglect the likelihood of the emergence of domain-specific counterfactual capacities, and these may limit the scope of the reliability of our counterfactual thought. This is particularly problematic for Williamson and Crudle, who rely on us having this domain-general counterfactual thought capacity. But I think it's really important for the rest of us too, even if you're not going to support this kind of approach. Because we tend to think of tend to move from there being a counterfactual conditional to this kind of view that there's this thing, counterfactual thought, when actually there may be many different types of counterfactual thought, which all need to be accounted for in slightly different ways. We don't need to be sceptical as a result of this. We should just be a bit more cautious. We can look to the ways in which the practices we engage in can overcome natural limitations, but that doesn't mean that we should ignore the origins of the natural origins of counterfactual thought altogether. So even when we kind of have culturally augmented counterfactual thought, we still have to use systems that evolved to serve some other purpose. And there may still be ways in which our counterfactual thought is therefore constrained by the limitations of the system that we're kind of reusing that we can't envisage without studying that system in more detail. So we should be cautious when kind of assuming that our thought is generally reliable, and the findings of the cognitive sciences regarding when counterfactual thought has limitations or not. So this has been a kind of quite freewheeling and loose argument that needs a lot of tightening up, and I'm going to be really interested to know what you think. But these are the kind of things I'm seeing going forward with this kind of point of view. So we need to think about the ways in which the reliability of counterfactual will be constrained by the question, and these need to be ascertained through empirical study because they're not the kind of constraints that will be accessible to introspection. Evolutionary justifications of domain general counterfactual thought are not currently supported, and there are good reasons to think they won't be. But that's not a problem, because evolutionary justifications are not the only way to get to domain general reliability. And the important thing is this, so Williamson and Crowe were initially attempting to overcome this sort of scepticism directed at philosophy, and did so by trying to appeal to evolutionary explanations. I think the key thing to see here is that it does quite the opposite. In order to believe that there's going to be any scope for progress in philosophy, we need to think that it's not the product of Stone Age minds carrying out counterfactual thought, it's the product of our cultural innovations, and new theories can lead to new ways of thinking about things. And by learning about the hidden constraints of counterfactual thought, we can actually become better at applying it in the cases where we expect it to be reliable and where we expect it to work. Thanks a lot for listening.
Thank you.